Dr. Stanley Krippner is professor of psychology at Saybrook Graduate School, as well as distinguished adjunct professor at the California Institute of Human Science and distinguished professor of psychology at the California Institute of Integral Studies, among others. The author of many books and more than 700 articles and chapters, he has served as president of the American Psychological Association's divisions of psychological hypnosis and humanistic psychology, the Association for the Study of Dreams, the Parapsychological Association, and the Association for Humanistic Psychology. Among his many awards are the Volcker Medal, the Volcker Medal, the Bicentennial Medal from the University of Georgia, and the Charlotte and Carl Bueller Award from the American Psychological Association. Thank you for joining us, Stanley.
Thank you. I'm so glad that you have done such a marvelous job of filling in the biographical details of my encounters with the dead, so I don't really have to do too much of that. But one of my pastimes that also got me into trouble with this FBI and the CIA was visits to the Soviet Union back in the early 1970s. And I had an interview with the author of the very first book on sexology for Soviet citizens. And he said, yes, the Soviet Union has finally discovered sex. So when Rob Weiner's book came out with a chapter on perspectives on the Grateful Dead, I thought, well, academia has finally discovered the Grateful Dead. And of course, there were some fine papers before that book, and there have been other books, and I've been familiar with the group that's here today and the Dead Studies. I'm just delighted that we have such a robust organization, and I also hope that you all have a copy of my pass out. It'll make my remarks much more comprehensible to you. There's tons of them up here. Just come up and pick one or pass them out.
Will you pass them over back, please?
Yes. Now, there are numerous aspects of my interaction with the dead that I could talk about, but I thought that it would be illustrative to go into the lens of shamanism to look at the dead, because it's a cliche that I've heard for decades, well, the Grateful Deads are modern shamans, at least to the deadheads. And so I want to examine that from the lens of shamanism. At Saybrook Graduate School, we actually have a course on the psychology of shamanism that I designed and that I teach. And so we have some excellent papers, some excellent studies, and we have many field studies that our master's and doctoral students have done. Now, there are many ways that one can define shamans, but we have to realize this is really a social construct, like just about any term that you can use in the social and behavioral sciences. Originally, the word shaman was used to describe Siberian shamans, because the word comes from saman, which might mean practitioner of austerities, or it might mean singer of sacred songs, or it might be a person of special wisdom. There are three possible translations for that word, and all of them apply, actually. Anthropologists eventually found out that indigenous societies all over the world have or had shamanic practitioners, and so the name became generalized. And in another paper, which you can look up on my website, I talk about how shamans were at first vilified, especially by the Christian missionaries who thought that they were doing the work of the devil, but eventually also by the psychiatrists who thought they were hopelessly psychotic. And Only in recent decades have there been psychological tests and measurements and observations done with shamans, even though these were standardized by Westerners. Nevertheless, it turns out that shamans were indeed the wisest and the most mentally healthy people in their community. So now shamans are being taken seriously. And also, I have been attending the annual shamanism conference in San Rafael, California for over 20 years. And Sidney and Morningstar, who some of you remember from Amherst and I, will be presenting a paper about Rolling Thunder at the Society for Shamanic Practitioners, because now there are a whole group of mental health specialists who use shamanic techniques. Do I consider them shamans? By and large, no. I think that they serve shamanic functions. And many of them have studied with shamans or have gone through courses of training to teach them how to do such things as retrieve souls during soul loss, to empower people during periods of depression, to mediate between the various levels of reality. And in doing this, they sometimes climb up the axis mundi, the pole of life, the sacred tree that you heard about, the banyan tree. Yes, that was such an appropriate title for the song that that Bob and Mickey wrote, and you've touched on some of the obvious metaphorical connections with that. Now, the definition of shaman that I use is in your passout. They're socially sanctioned practitioners who voluntarily regulate their attention to access information not ordinarily available, using it to facilitate healthy development and alleviate stress and illness among members of their community and their community as a whole. So somebody doesn't just come on the scene and say, I'm a shaman, come and get healed. A social group has to give them that particular designation. And indigenous societies, this is what is done. One study among, I believe, the Navajos tested dozens of people in a tribe and found that the people who claimed to be shamans but really had not received the social designation were at the bottom of the heap in terms of mental health. The shamans were at the top of the heap and the rest of the community were in between. So the community really knows what they are doing. They're careful when they put somebody in charge of their spiritual life and their psychological life. Indigenous tribes typically had a chief or chieftainess as well as shamans, and the sacred and the secular worked very well together. Then something strange happened. Agriculture came into the picture. And that meant that there was now a time and a place where you would worship and have sacred ceremonies. This was not the shaman's way of doing things. The shamans were more spontaneous, and they were very well suited to hunting and gathering societies. So you had the role of the priest or the priestess come in. In other words, you had institutionalized religion with all of its advantages and all of its disadvantages. And so the shaman simply became a healer rather than the person in charge of all of the sacred ceremonies. Also, you had some other practitioners like the witch, the sorcerer, the medium, the seer, the wizard, and we don't have time to go into those today. All of those might be viewed as outgrowths of the shaman in one way or another. Now, I like to say that shamans access non-ordinary information through modulating their attention rather than to use the hackneyed term altered states of consciousness. Because, again, using the Navajos as an example, when they do their sand paintings and their chant ways, the Hatali, the singing shaman, must recite a chant away for that particular person who's in the middle of the sand painting, who's ailing and has the community support. And they must do this word perfect. If they fail, they go back and start over again. So the chant will typically last for hours. Now, how can they do that if they're zonked out on drugs or half asleep from sleep deprivation? No, they have to be sharp. They modulate their attention by focus and by memory. So I have in the passout the six dreams of accessing non-ordinary information: drumming, dancing, dreaming, drugs, diet, and sensory deprivation of one sort or another. And it can be sleep deprivation, it can be going off to the desert or the mountains or the forests or the cave, but there are many, many ways that they prepare for these particular journeys. And they often journey with their clients. When I visited Maria Sabina, who plays a very important role in ethnomycology, the study of the ethnological use of sacred mushrooms, she told me that she typically would take the mushroom with her clients and they would go on these trips together. Now, shamans were also the first myth makers. Not only were they the first healers, the first psychologists, the first performing artists, but they were the first storytellers, and they made myths to explain the workings of the world using metaphors, symbols, and narrative. Now, just think for a moment about the Grateful Dead songbook and about some of the words and lyrics that you've heard so far this session. A lot of symbols, a lot of metaphors, a lot of similes, a lot of mythic narrative. And I don't think that it's pushing the envelope too far to say that the marvelous lyricists for the Grateful Dead were creating mythological narratives. And this originally was one of the things that attracted me to the Grateful Dead because of my friendship with Joseph Campbell and my longtime interest in myth. And I was thinking, you know, these lyrics are just right out of mythology. And as Nick was saying, I did interview most of the members of the Dead for the survey I did for the book Psychedelic Art by Masters in Houston. That book is now a collector's item because the publisher will not let it go into paperback, which it should because it has so many gorgeous pictures. I think it came out in 1968. And then I did an expanded search, including more musicians, for a book published by Stash. And then I did a final version for the Journal of Psychoactive Drugs. And so there are little bits and pieces of quotations from the Dead in that book, and sort of a summary of their drug history. And also some of the lyrics that reflect drug history, not only from the Grateful Dead, but from other groups as well. Now, symbols and metaphors help shamans make sense of their internal processes. Joseph Campbell, and this was one of the quotations that often gets neglected, said that myths arise from the body as well as from the observation of nature. You look into nature and you have to explain nature if you're going to survive, but you also have to explain the workings of your body, your bodily changes during puberty, during menstruation, during menopause, during illness, during health, during death. And so, again, if you look at the Grateful Dead lyrics, you find explanatory phrases and even whole songs explaining how the world works. Now, there are two types of myths, in my opinion. There's a descriptive myth and there's a prescriptive myth. A descriptive myth describes how things are. A prescriptive myth tells what to do. You have the marvelous opening, driving that train high on cocaine. That's not telling people to use cocaine. That's not a prescriptive myth. That's a descriptive myth. It's telling about how things were for Casey Jones. And you can think of other examples too. But myths also describe the natural environment, they describe the interactions with other people, and the interactions with the spirit world. And this is why so many people say that going to a dead concert was like having a spiritual experience. And Phil Lesh once said, any place we played was like a church. So the spiritual element came in very, very early. And one way that I thought it was worthwhile to spend more time with the Grateful Dead is that during these interviews, we would talk about other things. And Jerry was very knowledgeable about the yogic chakra system and the music and the tones that went with each chakra. Phil Lesh was very knowledgeable about opera. I didn't know at that time, his training in classical music. Bob Weir, even back in those days, was interested in indigenous people and the rainforest. Mickey Hart gave me a wonderful lecture on the origins of jazz and how it spread up the Mississippi River. That, well, these are people of real substance. They are sharp, they are intelligent, they know what they are doing. And that has remained to this day. When I have conversations with them, it covers a wide range of topics. Now, shamanic states of consciousness can include dreams and visions, intuitions and feelings, observations of the natural world, observations of the social world. Yes, you get all of that in the lyrics and the music of the Grateful Dead. In evolutionary psychology, one always asks, how did this trait survive because it was adaptable? Well, the human brain is able to solve problems, is able to use reason, and that was adaptable. But there is also an intuitive function, not an irrational, but a non-rational function of the brain and the body that also survived. And that's where the shaman picked up on functions, because the shaman had much greater gifts of intuition than the other members of the community, was able to forecast weather, was able to tell where the enemy were camped, was able to find out where the game could be found by sharp observation, by intuitive powers. And if the shaman was not able to do that, the shaman was put into retirement, or in worst case scenarios, was exiled or even killed. Being a shaman was a risky profession. And I think that rightfully so, because they were so necessary to the health of the tribe. Now, myths, and think here of Grateful Dead lyrics while I read this statement. From a psychological perspective, myths are statements or stories that address existential human concerns and have behavioral consequences. They explain natural phenomena, they guide people through life transitions, they assign people their place in society, they connect people with spiritual realms. Those four are from Joseph Campbell. The definition is, for me, that's my psychological definition of myth, because you can pin it down. It's what we call an operational definition in psychology, and you can decide if something is a myth or not. Common themes in shamanic training include death and rebirth, assisting transitions, care of the soul. So here, push comes to shove in terms of the Grateful Dead being shamans. No, they did not have shamanic training. They had superb training one way or another in other things, in music, in learning from life, in travel, from working with each other. But the shamanic functions that they performed and the spiritual empowerment they gave to people, I think, happened almost accidentally. It was not something that they deliberately set out to do. It was a confluence of the need of the community and what the dead had to offer. And it was a very fortuitous confluence. Well, we go on and say myths are often enacted in community bonding activities, rites, rituals, ceremonies. These mythic performances reinforce belief systems, moral codes, and social and personal identities. And again, think of the Grateful Dead shows, which I often use as an example of a ritual. Rituals are prescribed and stylized step-by-step performances of mythic themes. They attempt to promote social solidarity. It certainly did that at a dead concert. They attempt to accompany life or cultural transitions, yes, in terms of helping people find their identity and growing up. They attempt to reinforce communities' values, belief systems, and rules of conduct. They certainly did that. So a Grateful Dead show, and really many, many rock group shows, were ritual. They performed all of the functions of what anthropologists and psychologists have described as rituals. And I have a few examples here, including not only the Grateful Dead concerts, but the Northwest Indian giveaway potlatches, the ayahuasca visiones from the rainforest in Peru, the Amazon, and Ecuador, the huichol naricas, the Mazatec veladas with the sacred mushrooms, and myths drive rituals, rituals enact and reinforce myths. Now, another important way that the dead are really lacking the role, the name of shaman, is with the call. The call is the way by which a practitioner elects to follow a spiritual vocation or social path. Reading the biographies of the dead, talking with the dead, they were called to be musicians. And some of these calls are very dramatic. But no, they were not called to be shamans. That's why I say they perform many shamanic functions without being shamans themselves. At least that's my opinion. I really am very conservative in terms of using the word shaman. Indigenous people have had so much taken away from them over the years, even by academics. Let's give them, you know, credit for keeping the word shaman, or whatever their equivalent of it is, whether it's Curandero or Sabia or Huatili or Paje, and let's not appropriate that with a group that is doing good things in its own right. Now, that's not to say that there are people in the non-indigenous world who are shamans. Yes, some of them have put in years studying with shamans. They've paid their dues. And if an indigenous teacher calls them a shaman, that's good enough for me. Well, in shamanism, a call may take one of several forms. A serious illness or accident from which one recovers, this is the wounded healer call. A hereditary legacy. Shamanic practices are often passed from parents to children. Now, we know that Mickey Hart had relatives who were musicians, so did Jerry Garcia. So there is a hereditary factor there, but to be musicians, not to be shamans. Or a dream, vision, or visitation from a spirit deity or deceased shaman. Now, the very last page of your passout is provocative. I think that Jim Morrison did have a shamanic call. You read The Doors, you read his biographies, and I think that a dead shaman who he ran into with his family on the road passed his spirit to Morrison. And I think that Morrison flubbed it. I think he goofed. He had a wonderful education. I heard The Doors once, great music. Very intelligent, I've read his book of poetry, but no discipline. To be a shaman, you have to have discipline. And so I've written a whole article about Morrison's, it's published, it's also available on my website, on how Morrison, I think, came the closest of any rock musician to being a shaman, and he dropped the ball. But now let's get back and conclude by looking at the Grateful Dead once more. Yes, they had rituals, and they performed shamanic roles. People like her who have studied the Deadheads know how many lives were changed, and in my opinion, usually for the better, by their attendance at the rock concerts, their immersion in the Grateful Dead, and how phrases from the Grateful Dead became part of their vernacular, part of their daily conversation. And that's what happens with myth. You say these words, you utter these mythic themes without even realizing that you're doing it, because they give some shape and form to their life. So, that's all that I'm going to say right now to give us a little time for questions. Grateful Dead, shamans, no. Performing shamanic functions, yes. Let's be thankful for that. Mm-hmm.